Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, a board-certified OBGYN and menopause specialist. My new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it really takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Every week, I sit down with medical experts, cultural icons, and powerhouse women to talk about what really matters, your health, your power, and your future. We're covering hormones, identity, finances, relationships, and so much more. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Unpaused with me, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so the big news, I think, for us is the weather, man, because here's the deal. It's going to be nice today. It's 50 degrees outside right now, going up to 74. Just, if you have not been outside in the afternoon, just perfect weather. 77 tomorrow, a little bit warmer, 77 on Thursday, warming through the weekend. Then a chance for showers on Sunday as a cold front comes through. We reach the high temperature early on Sunday. Temperatures plummet throughout the day. Highs, the high temperature next Monday, 54 and windy. So ladies, with your boots or whatever winter wear you like, guys, whatever you like to wear, get it out because you're going to be able to wear it. And then highs of only 56 on Tuesday. And then warming to 68 on Wednesday. So it's November. It's going to turn cool just in time. And we're happy for that here. At least I am at WWL. Let's talk about the filibuster, shall we? President Trump wants to get rid of it. And believe it or not, we do some research on this show. And I'm looking at a story from CNN that an editor's note says a version of this story was first published in 2021 when Democrats were trying to end the filibuster. So before anybody goes crazy with the text line about President Trump this, Democrats that, keep in mind it's all about who's in power at the time and who can best benefit from doing whatever it is they can do. With that, we welcome in Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's start with filibuster 101 for people that know of it, but perhaps don't know what exactly it is. What is a filibuster?
So basically, the filibuster is preventing a bill from getting a floor vote in the Senate. So in the House of Representatives, there is a motion called motion to table, and the motion in the House in order to call for a vote doesn't exist in the Senate rules, which means that as long as you have the floor to keep debating, you can keep talking, and then you can give the floor to one of your friends.
Wait, go back a second, Professor, if you can. I want to go slow because it's early and we're talking about the House here, right? Yeah.
Okay, so in the House, all you have to do is call for a vote, and that just requires passing that motion on a strict majority line.
So in the House, if I'm talking about a bill, another member can rise according to the procedure and say what? Table
is. So in the House, all that has to happen is you introduce a motion to call for a floor vote. That motion requires a strict majority to pass. You can end debate, and then you just get a floor vote.
At any point, I can do this. If somebody's talking, I can stand up and say this. I can say, Mr. whatever it is, Speaker, whoever's running the House at the time, I call for a floor vote on blah, 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 blah. And a simple majority ends it, right?
Basically, you can also have a rule in the House which will end debate after a specific period of time, and that's written into the rule for a bill.
All right.
So there are a bunch of ways in the House that will just end debate and prevent this endless debate. Now, in the Senate, it doesn't work that way. So in the Senate, what will happen is that you can start talking, and you can talk for as long as you want to talk, and then you can give the floor to one of your friends who will talk and talk and talk, and then that can go on endlessly. And the only way to end debate in the Senate is with a motion called cloture. So there's a specific motion in the Senate called the cloture motion. Now, this was introduced in 1917. And the original threshold for a cloture motion when it was introduced in 1917 was two-thirds. So you had to get two-thirds of the Senate to agree to end debate and vote on a bill. Mm-hmm. So it would require a majority to pass a bill, but you had to get two-thirds of the Senate to agree to end debate to get to that majority threshold.
Now, hang on one second. Let me just go slow if I can, Professor, because for a lot of us, the only reference we have to this is Mr. Smith goes to Washington and Jimmy Stewart talking until he was hoarse, right, and all of that stuff. So at that point in the 30s, whenever it was, somebody could stand up while they were reading, because I remember in high school civics, they would tell us, you know, they would read this, they would read that, they'd read the phone book, whatever it was to keep the floor. As long as they could keep talking, they could keep the floor. But at any point, somebody could have stood up and called for a vote on cloture if they had two-thirds of the votes, and that's why they were counting votes in the chambers and all that kind of stuff?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So now, two-thirds is really hard to get, obviously.
Right.
So in 1975, they reduced the threshold to three-fifths, which is still hard to get. Mm-hmm. And when you have 100 senators, that means you had to get 60 votes in order to end debate.
And that's where we are now, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where we are now for regular bills. So there are a couple of exceptions. So we use the nuclear option for judicial positions and executive branch appointments, and we can talk about that.
Yes,
and
let's talk about the nuclear option since you brought it up. What is that?
Yeah. Okay, so the nuclear option is basically where the majority party says that the rules don't exist. The rules are whatever we say they are because we're the majority party and we have more votes. Hmm. That's the nuclear option. It's basically cheating and using the fact that there are more majority party members than minority party members by definition, ignoring the rules and saying the rules don't mean anything because we say so.
So why wouldn't they, if they have a majority, why wouldn't they do it all the time?
So the reason not to do that is because at some point the majority and the minority will flip. If you are in the majority now, at some point you will be in the minority. And when you are in the minority, you will want to be able to filibuster, because whatever you want to do when you are in the majority, well, think about the minority party and the things that they will want to do that you want to stop. You will then want to filibuster what the minority, what the current minority, then majority, will want to do. And if you don't have the filibuster available to you, then they will be able to ram through all the things that they want to do, and you won't be able to stop them. So the filibuster is basically a way to kind of moderate the policymaking process.
But wait, let me interrupt for one second just to understand. So the majority party at any point can change the rules and either bring back or do away with the filibuster?
Well, it can do away with the filibuster, but it can't really bring it back, because once you do away with the filibuster, you've thrown out the rules and you've thrown out all trust. It's hard to bring it back. It's hard to come back from it, which is why we call it the nuclear option.
But they have done it before, right?
Well, we've gone in one direction. We've gone in the direction of getting rid of the filibuster for judicial appointments and executive branch appointments. We haven't gone in the other direction. We haven't brought the filibuster back. It's kind of a one-way thing. Once you get rid of the filibuster, bringing it back is kind of hard to conceive of, because once you do that, you have created a Senate in which the majority party just throws out the rules whenever they feel like it.
I got
and
you.
It's hard to come back from that.
I got you. But they have used, when it comes to reconciliation, that's a different thing as well, correct?
Yeah, that's a different thing, because that's actually written into the rules. So there's a process called budget reconciliation, and budget reconciliation automatically ends debate after a set period of time, so you don't have to call for cloture. Now, you can only use budget reconciliation in specific ways on specific kinds of bills, but when you use budget reconciliation, debate ends after a specific period of time, so there's no need for a cloture vote. So it's written into the rules. You don't need to use the nuclear option, and you can use budget reconciliation on specifically fiscal issues. You're not allowed to increase the deficit for more than 10 years, so there are some limitations. But because it's written into the rules of the Senate, It's not the majority party saying the rules mean whatever we say they mean because we're in the majority party. Well,
let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, because what I'm hearing is either karma or payback, however you want to look at it. You better watch what you ask for, because you might get it, because next time you might be on the wrong side of this. And that's why John Thune is saying, no, hang on a second, we're not going to do away with the filibuster. We'll pick it up when we come back, talking to Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, because when it comes to national political policy, personally, I don't think it can hurt to understand what the heck it is we're talking about. 622 Traffic Now, WWL. 627 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, about the filibuster, how the President Trump wants to kill it. John Thune, the majority leader in the Senate, says he does not. Somebody texted in, I don't know if they've been listening or not, but says the Republicans need to go nuclear. They need to use the majority that they have and open the government. If they were to do away with the filibuster, for this person that texted in and is all for it now, what would they have to consider in the future, Professor? Apparently, I don't know if they understood the first part of the conversation or not.
What that person would have to consider would be what would happen if there would be, say, a President Ocasio-Cortez and a Democratic majority in the House and Senate after the 2028 election. I suspect that whoever texted that in is probably a Republican who would not be happy with what would happen with a President Ocasio-Cortez and a Democratic House and Senate, because there would be no Republican filibuster to stop whatever would happen under that scenario, because this works both ways. You cannot create an option that is going to be used by your party that won't then be turned around on you when you're in the minority. And that's exactly what the filibuster is. It's a tool to stop the majority party, whichever party is the majority, and then serves as kind of a moderating influence.
This goes to the nature of the founding fathers and the Senate being the more deliberative body, does it not?
Yeah, there's actually some historical debate on whether the filibuster was intentional, because there's the previous question motion is the motion specifically written into the House rules for ending debate. And the previous question motion was not introduced into the Senate rules. And how intentional was that? But there's a lot of other evidence that the Senate was intended to be a moderating influence, even aside from that. And that was very much the founder's intent. Yeah.
Even to the 6-year terms, right?
Yes, that's part of it. Also, the Senate was not originally directly elected. That's also part of it.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. The shutdown does have consequences. Michael Williamson will join us when we come back. He's the CEO of United Way of Southeast Louisiana. We'll talk about food insecurity in general in Louisiana, about the new ALIS study, especially with concerns over how much SNAP funding is going to go out in November, because now I think they're given half SNAP benefits, which seems like you try to please all in the end by pleasing none. I don't know. We'll see when he comes on. Right now it's time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:46, 14 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Thanks for getting your Tuesday morning started with us. A beautiful Tuesday morning it is. Michael Williamson joins us, CEO of United Way of Southeast Louisiana, talk about food insecurity in Louisiana, especially with concerns over SNAP funding and how much of it's going out. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about ALIS households and what those are. I tried to explain it before, but you could probably do a better job than I could, of what the studies that you do indicate and what an ALIS household is. And this is irrespective of SNAP funding or cuts in SNAP funding, right?
Sure. So ALIS, we consider now the ALIS Data Research Project. Let's start with ALIS as an acronym. It stands for Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. So by definition, these are folks that are working every day to get by and meet their basic needs, including food. And the harsh reality, Tommy, is one out of every two households throughout Southeast Louisiana and the entire state, for that matter, are considered ALIS, which means they're one hardship away from financial peril and falling into poverty.
So, to be clear, these are people that are working. I think there is this misconception that people that are receiving help, especially when it comes to food benefits, sit at home. They don't want to work. They hang out on a porch all day, blah, 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 blah. And that is not the case.
That's not the case. You know, a large number of, Dallas households in general, a large number of SNAP recipients are folks that are working. And, you know, if you the acronym of SNAP, it stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which means it's meant to supplement a family's food budget. And so, once again, in our state, one out of every two households is considered ALIS, means a large number of folks are out there that need those benefits in order to feed their families.
Is there a snapshot, if you will, of the typical ALIS recipient?
So, yeah, the typical, I mean, these are folks, we talk about it all the time, Tommy. These are folks you know, like you go into medical practice. Often, you know, it could be a nursing aide or, you know, the barista in your coffee shop or a clerk at a grocery store or any number of jobs that we rely on every day for people to do those are considered ALIS. You know, and they're working hard trying to make ends meet, that they still struggle. And oftentimes they need these, you know, supplemental programs to help make sure that they've got a roof over their head and food on the table.
It's not getting any better, is it?
No, it's the you know, we see as those folks move, what we consider abject poverty based on federal standards for measuring poverty, into ALIS means they don't qualify for public benefit programs often, but they're still not earning enough. But overall, the top line number doesn't vary a great deal. It may go from 9 to 50%. And our commitment at United Way is to help those families, what we call get on pathways to prosperity, so that they can be more financially stable and independent.
We got a little bit of a phone issue. I don't know if it's on our end or yours. We're going to try to resolve it during the break because I want to hear every word that you have to say, Micah. We'll talk about SNAP when we come back. 6:50, 10 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Micah Williamson, CEO, United Way of Southeast Louisiana, about how big of a problem is food insecurity. We'll talk about it parish by parish as well when we come back, because it's easy to look at the state as one entity when, in fact, it's not. Obviously, it's a lot of different entities. Traffic now, WWL. 6:56, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back to Micah Williamson, CEO of United Way of Southeast Louisiana. Michael, are there parishes that are more affected than others in Louisiana? I would think there are.
Yeah, we see some inconsistencies, obviously, when it comes to a parish by parish look. But I'll give you just a contrast looking at neighboring parishes. So in Jefferson Parish, as an example, 33% of households are considered ALIS, while 16% live in poverty. But if you go down and you look at Orleans Parish, the numbers are a good bit different, where you have 29% of households are considered ALIS, living slightly above poverty, but with 23% living in poverty. And the state numbers are 30% and 19%. So you can see variations from parish to parish and across the region, about 1 in 2, as I mentioned before.
Talk about the SNAP funding and how important that is and how that affects ALIS households, because I don't understand. The logic of this doesn't sit with me with the half of the benefits. It's like, well, if you need to go into a reserve fund to pay benefits and the benefits are needed, well, then you need to pay all of the benefits. Going into the reserve fund to pay half the benefits, well, that's just saying we're just going to ease your pain halfway. I don't understand the logic of that. Tell me about the effect of it.
Well, and let's also remember, once again, it's supplemental. Mm-hmm. And so this is necessary for families to feed themselves. And so if they have to stretch even farther, I mean, children and families are going to go hungry. And, you know, you look at the economic impacts of that. Like, people can't, you know, show up to work, fully ready to work if they're hungry. Kids can't learn in school if they're hungry. So we certainly believe those benefits need to be, you know, fully paid and ensure that the families have those resources. Is this necessary to folks, you know, being able to be successful each and every day?
Why do you think so many people struggle with accepting the fact that hardworking people are facing food insecurity? I'll give you my opinion. I think it's because if you go to a buffet or you go to a nice meal at a restaurant, you are so full when you leave, you can't even imagine eating again or why anybody would ever want to eat. And I think that sometimes people that have it pretty good, and they work hard, and I understand that, but a lot of us get breaks in our lives that a lot of us don't. They can't quite understand how, well, if I'm not hungry, how can somebody else be hungry? Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, I think, you know, once again, the reality is, like, you know, the cost of goods, the cost of food, et cetera, has outpaced wages for a very, very long time. And so families have been forced to stretch. And so, you know, folks have been, and oftentimes, you know, those of us who are able to put food on the table and feed our families and walk away with that full experience, like, I've had a good meal and I'm full, you know, have kind of forgotten what it's like to be hungry. And I think if you think back to those moments where you were hungry, it all make a lot more sense. But you know, with one or two households struggling, we know so many going hungry, these benefits are essential. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us that we can encourage our legislators to obviously, you know, end the shutdown, bring back those benefits. In the meantime, let's do all we can to support our food bank.
What can people do to help? I was going to ask you that.
Absolutely. So the easiest thing to do is to go to our website, UnitedWaySELA.org. Right there, you'll see it on the main page. We have both a way for folks to give and help out, but also if you're in need, you know, finding a food bank or other resources, we have a resource page as well.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time and your efforts. Michael Williamson, CEO, United Way of Southeast Louisiana. We're going to talk with an agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center. A lot of farmers depend on federal agencies for financial assistance as well. Sometimes the poor get singled out, but the federal government gives a lot of assistance to a lot of people. We'll talk about it when we come back. WWL. It is 7:14, beautiful week ahead, and then it turns really cold by next weekend. So if you like the cold weather, you can look forward to that. Michael Deliberto joins us now, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus. How you doing, Professor?
Oh, I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I am okay, sir. Let's talk about Louisiana farmers and how are they doing with the shutdown, and then we'll go into tariffs.
Sure. Well, you know, Tommy, with the government shutdown that's in place, I think producers got a little bit of good news over the past week when the USDA announced that it would be opening some of its offices around the country at the Farm Service Agency to help producers get access to conservation program payments, agricultural risk coverage payments, which were revenue support programs from the 2014 crop year that were made that wouldn't be available until October of 2025. So, you know, some key offices and the closures really affect the culture. But really, the biggest thing is the release of government reports out of the USDA that monitor crop progress, harvest progress, the size of the crops. With the Midwest, with the corn and soybean harvest coming online right now, the USDA has a critical role in providing information for the market that's fundamental in nature, the size of the crop, the number of exports we have, the number of crops that were shipped out of the port facilities. And that's news that the market needs to really maintain the rallies and the support and the strength of the market. So I think we're all hopeful that, you know, the shutdown is going to end hopefully pretty soon to where we can have a return to normalcy, if you will, to where this information can get out and, you know, it can provide producers some information on the market, but also it can help them set up their crop plans for next year already. This is a critical time when farmers in Louisiana, we just finished harvesting our crops, but, you know, we're getting ready to meet with our agricultural lenders and our bankers to finalize plans for 2026 already. And with some of these FSA offices and USDA offices being closed, what about loan processing? Farmers that need to apply for financing for next year. So the stall in the backlog of all this, it is starting to concern, you know, some farmers in terms of being able to meet their financing needs for 2026 already.
So when you say conservation payments and reserve support payments, what are those?
Conservation reserve payments are conservation payments for working agricultural lands that producers enter into an agreement with USDA to where their marginally productive lands are set aside, they're taken out of production, and the USDA pays them a rental rate per acre, and that's done to maintain, say, like wildlife habitat, grasslands, wetlands, and things like that. that really these lands wouldn't be well suited for production agriculture, but they do have benefit for, say, wildlife or conservation or soil health. So farmers can choose to put those lands in a conservation program. So where they're able to generate some money from those lands, instead of trying to invest all the money to get those marginal lands ready for crop production, that really may not be a financially lucrative endeavor to pursue. But in Louisiana, some of those programs are done through private public partnerships through entities like Ducks Unlimited, where we're creating wildlife and waterfowl habitat, migratory bird habitat, et cetera. And it's really been a pretty strong source of diversification to maybe combat some of these low prices, high input costs that farmers are seeing for some of these marginal lands. Maybe they're more well-suited for conservation, and those agreements are entered into between state agencies, federal agencies, and the agricultural producers here in Louisiana.
Somebody texted in, how dependent is the average farmer on payments from the federal government, which is not a bad question.
Tommy, most farmers are going to say they want to farm for the market. Mm-hmm. These support payments that we have from the federal government, they are in no means a way to keep farmers in the black, to keep farmers farming from year to year in terms of, well, if the market's not there, I know that I'm getting these support programs. That's not the case. If anything, these support programs from a revenue or a price standpoint are only designed to trigger when certain market conditions present themselves. Say we have revenue that drops below 80% of the historical average. If the market price drops below a statutorily defined reference price in the farm bill, but these are only on a small share of the farm's acres. Farmers aren't paid and getting payments on every single acre they plant because the World Trade Organization, how we support our farmers, you know, we play by the rules of the international commodity markets and saying that we don't provide any subsidies that would discourage or distort the market from planting crops every year. We much rather would see these returns come from high market prices. That's always the goal. But in these tight times that we're in now, these payments are really just being a bridge to let farmers secure their financing and to show some kind of cash flow for the next crop year. It is by no means a way that these farms can really survive long term in the absence of high market prices, if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, are they payments or loans?
Some are payments, but are made, again, on a fraction of those farm acres. So, again, it's, you know, to put it in perspective, a payment may be, you know, $50 or $60 an acre, but, you know, a farmer could sustain a loss anywhere of $150 to $200 an acre. So by no means is it a complete offset to, say, low yields or low prices.
But it's still a benefit that they're getting, right, from the government?
It is. And it's been around in ad policy, believe it or not. A lot of this ad policy is rooted all the way back to 1930s era farm policy, where the need was to support farm prices and farm incomes. Now we've moved to a more market-oriented approach in how these policies and programs are dispersed from the federal government to the producers, but they're really designed to support prices and incomes really in times of extremely low prices and farm incomes.
And I'm not trying to knock those payments at all. I'm just trying to, you know, everybody's paying attention to what the government's paying out now, and I'm just trying to get a handle on what it is exactly that they are paying it out. What kind of, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll talk about tariffs when we come back. We're talking to Michael Deliberto, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus, about how Louisiana farmers are doing with the shutdown and tariffs. 720 traffic now, WWL. It is currently 7:26. Tommy Tucker, WWL, in the midst of the government shutdown, talking to Michael Deliberto, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus. Let's talk about tariffs. What kind of effect has that had on Louisiana farmers?
Well, Tommy, certainly with these tariffs, it's caused a delay in exports, especially for, say, soybeans. Soybeans are one of our leading agricultural exports. China had traditionally been a large buyer of U.S. soybeans, and with this tariff uncertainty that, you know, was in the markets over the better part of, say, the last, you know, almost year or so, they've diversified to buying soybeans from Brazil, and with the absence of a major export customer like China out of the U.S. market, you know, that created a lot of uncertainty for the market because we were sitting on really two good years of soybean crops here in the U.S. So you had a lot of farmers that were holding their soybeans and hoped that the market would maybe tick up, this trade situation would resolve itself. So we had a lot of crops in storage. And really, the soybean market in general, it was really a market that was sideways and struggling for direction. I mean, we had a lot of soybeans being used for domestic consumption, like soybean meal and soybean oil, biofuels here in the U.S., but it cannot make up for the lost export share that we're seeing right now. But with the news last week that China has agreed to buy as many as 12 million metric tons of soybeans from the U.S., you know, I think that's a positive sign for the industry. The soybean prices have rallied to a 15-month high, and I think that's a positive news for a U.S. soybean farmer and a Louisiana soybean farmer in general. So I think some of that uncertainty is starting to be alleviated. However, we still need those sales to actually get on the books. We still need those soybeans to leave U.S. ports and start going into China, and I think that's going to be a big win for agriculture. And there's also rumors that, you know, China's also looking to purchase milo, which is grain sorghum, and also cotton from the U.S. But, you know, so much of the crops we produce here in the U.S., like corn and soybeans, cotton and soybeans, excuse me, for instance, so much of that's going to be dependent upon global factors because we're a major exporter of both those products. So how much supply is out there in the world? Where are these major countries like China? If they're not buying from us, where are they buying from? So there's a lot of things that go into you know, finding some clarity in this, but I think we're definitely moving in a step in the right direction to solving some of these trade disputes we're having.
What kind of lead time is there when it comes to planting soybeans and the market, et cetera?
Typically, soybeans in Louisiana, you know, our producers, we grow soybeans on over 1 million acres in the state, and soybeans is a plant that different varieties have different maturing dates, so mm-hmm. it allows producers to plant some early. Like soybean or sugarcane farmers would maybe plant soybeans early so they can get them out, say, in August before they want to go ahead and plant their sugarcane crop on their fallow lands. Guys in the Northeast and the Delta in Louisiana, they may plant soybeans later so they can harvest them, say, in October, for instance. So typically when we're looking at marketing plans for producers, they're identifying their cost of production when they plant soybeans. If they plant soybeans in, say, April, they're going to say, or May, they're going to say, okay, my cost of production is X dollars a bushel, therefore I'm going to need to get at least that out of the market. So when the market hits that, they can execute some sales. But over the past couple years, so input prices have been super high, driven by fertilizer, chemical, fuel prices. So the cost of production has been up. So farmers really are having to wait until the market can send them the signal to where they're actually going to generate a positive return on their crop. And it's been tough in the past 2 or 3 years, especially with soybeans being really below the cost of production from a price standpoint.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your time and your insight. Michael Deliberto, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus. Hope we helped you understand some of that. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate, spend some time talking about Brian Kelly's final days with the Tigers. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, very, very happy to welcome in as our next guest to talk about Brian Kelly and the mess, the dumpster fire. It depends on, I guess, at what point you want to look at a dumpster fire. Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Good morning, Wilson. Thank you for taking the time with us.
Thank you for having me on. Hope you all doing okay.
We are, sir, and I hope you are too. Tell me about, I don't even want to get in the middle of your story. It's such a well-written piece. I would just like you to kind of give us the highlights of it. Brian Kelly's problems, you know, it seems like reading the story to me, he billed himself as an attention to detail guy, but yet he really wasn't when it came to the things that maybe needed his attention. Would that be accurate or not?
I hadn't really thought of it in those exact terms, but as you say it, I think that that conclusion could possibly be drawn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go so far as to say that's definitively it, because I think it's sort of in some cases hear matters of opinion. But that seems to be a fair, I think, a fair thing to say.
And let me just jump in real quick why I said that, because the part of when you meet a player and then you forget about it and then you say, well, it's been nice to meet you, to the player, that's like, well, bro, you didn't even, you don't even remember who I am, right?
Yeah, and that certainly is where a lot of people who have been around the program the past 4 years say that Brian Kelly fell short. And that was a common criticism of him, is that he did not connect with enough of his players. There were some players who said they had solid relationships with Brian Kelly. One, a former captain I spoke to, said he was close. Mm-hmm. He also acknowledged that it may have been because he was a captain. There was this sort of inability to connect with enough people and relate to enough people and really just win over enough people who are important around the program and also, you know, just his players as well. But to go back to what you said about attention to detail, I hesitated because I know there are moments when he was did have the attention to detail that that you would want from a head coach. I think, though, that he wanted everybody else around him to kind of have the attention to detail and then be able to be maybe a little bit hands off. And that was as I was told by many people, too hands off. And maybe lack that attention to detail in that way, yes.
You know, something else I got from reading your story is that, and it's going to sound terrible to say it, and I don't mean it too, but almost as though he was from the north and not one of us. It sounds terrible to say that, Wilson, but do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, though that came up quite a few times, and it's sort of in his just, as people tried to describe his leadership style, his interactions with people, being, you know, as one staff member put it to me, in a one-on-one situation, he was really good, where he could be funny and cordial and respectful. But then he would get into the bigger group settings, and another staff member used the word brash, where he would sort of raise his voice, and it felt maybe a little bit performative. And I think that just didn't translate. And you know, people from the moment he got hired, they talked about, oh, this doesn't feel like a good fit and all of that. And I guess ultimately in terms of his personality, maybe it wasn't. One person said that a longtime sort of current staff member, that Kelly brought in some things that needed to be done and did some things really well. This particular person thought that his messaging was always good. He brought in some structure that needed to be in place at the time when he took over after the end of the Ed Orgeron era, but that ultimately LSU lost its edge.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. One other thing I got from your article is that he kind of had one foot in, one foot out, and you know, you're kind of lost if you're in no man's land, right? You neither fish or fowl. Maybe I'm reading the wrong thing. I don't know, but we'll pick it up when we come back. Talking to Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Got a great piece at NOLA.com about the inside goings-on behind Brian Kelly's tenure and his firing and the differences between when he was at Notre Dame and here. And I think it's a very insightful piece. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. Might help if I turn my microphone on. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. He's got a tremendous article written at NOLA.com that you can go back and read if you like. I would suggest you do. Did Brian Kelly have enough of a hand in what he wanted to do? And I mentioned that he had one foot in, one foot out. I think he did in terms of culture. I think he did in terms of managing the organization. I think maybe the administration might have had one foot in, one foot out. Here's the thing I'm trying to say, Wilson. I'm all for responsibility with authority. It's like, you know what? If you're going to hold me responsible, by God, I'm going to pick my own staff. If you don't like it, fire me. Of course, there was the buyout consideration that factors into this as well. But did he have enough of it, of his own say, or were they trying to protect him from himself?
Well,
that's a lot of questions, huh?
Yes.
Bobby Hebert taught me that, Wilson. There. Bobby Hebert taught me how to ask those questions.
Well, to answer the last one, did he have enough to say? Yeah, he had a hand in everything. I will say, okay, if you look back to the beginning of Brian Kelly's tenure, he was given the permission, the ability to shape that staff the way that he wanted. Mm-hmm. And that included getting rid of a lot of longtime LSU staff members, Tommy Moffitt, Corey Raymond. Obviously, Blake Baker was on staff, and they let him go and then had to bring him back. Austin Thomas was already there. And then in 2023, bringing him back, a lot of those guys back, was something that was not only a Brian Kelly decision. Scott Woodward was heavily involved in that. And then as the things began to morph, you know, and LSU brings in Austin Thomas to sort of run the roster management and the GM and all of that. I think Kelly was okay with that, but it certainly, as he said before, was different than anything he had ever previously done in his career. And that's not a surprise. He's been a career for a head coach for 30 plus years. This is not how college football has worked up until recently. So he had to adapt. And I think in some ways, as some staff members said, he did adapt. It just never really worked. I think the reason it never really worked, might not quite be so much because of that, but because his style works if you have really good assistant coaches around you. Mm-hmm. You look back to Notre Dame the last 5 years when they won 10 straight games in a row. His defensive coordinators, he had three straight. All of them are now head coaches at power programs and having success. If he's going to delegate the way that he does.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan, $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer, first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17 point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody's got to be really good. And there was always an issue with the staff at one every single season. Questions about somebody needing to get fired here at LSU.
Do you think Frank Wilson has any shot at the job at all?
If LSU wins out,
yeah,
then maybe it becomes a discussion. I think where things stand at this point, most likely it would be a long shot, I would say at this point.
Hey, look, I appreciate you coming on. I'm very sorry about your loss. I mean that sincerely, Wilson.
Thank you so much. I appreciate y'all having me and hope you have a good rest of your day.
God bless you, man. Thank you. Wilson Alexander, staff writer for NOLA.com. Go read that story. Brian Kelly's ended LSU inside the Tigers coach demise. Very well researched, very well written. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Jason Williams with this funding mess. Talk about a dumpster fire with the city. He's worried about his department. We'll talk when we come back. WWL. All right, 8:15, joined by Jason Williams, New Orleans district attorney. How you doing, sir?
I am good. Tommy, how are you?
I'm okay. I guess you're letting everybody out of jail for free and not trying anybody and so forth, right?
Working day and night, Tommy.
I'm just going by and I'm just going by social media, Jason. That's all.
Yeah, I go by sometimes, too. It keeps me up at night.
Yeah. No, don't do it. Tell me what's going on at the DA's office, seriously.
Well, you know, we are Andre Godin, my chief of screening, who was the one who set up our district screening program, has really stepped up, and he's sort of our efficiency czar at the moment. He's looking at every single place where we can take austerity measures to really make sure that we are ready for what may be coming in terms of this fiscal cliff. You know, the public safety space is just not really a space where you can fix your budget. There are needed impacts, but you also have very lasting impacts when you start cutting into law enforcement agencies that have to do the same amount of work or sometimes more work during our tough budget times.
Have you presented the budget yet for 2026?
Yes, we went before the city council and we discussed our goals for this upcoming year. Before we got word that there had been a lot of misinformation about what the deficit was, there were a number of spaces in which we were trying to really expand upon our work, especially in the space of domestic violence. There have been at least five murder suicides in 3 months' time, which is more than we had in all of last year. Chief Kirkpatrick and I have been really working to try to find if there's any commonalities or through lines between that space. Mental health is certainly a part of that. And so we were trying to stand up a completely vertical domestic violence unit that would take a case from inception, regardless of how small, to the very end, and working with Jenna Vegno and the health department so that we're getting in front of those cases, dealing with young people who are present where there's domestic violence, making sure that they're getting some sort of treatment as well to make sure that they don't themselves become abusers or find themselves in abusive situations.
So I don't understand how, you know, they talk about in economics, elastic or inelasticity. I don't see how your budget can be very elastic at all because, I'm getting confused. Either way, your budget is what it needs to be, right? I don't know how you can do more with less, can you?
We can't. We can't. We don't have as many homicide prosecutors as we have set up as a goal with the city council. And so we've got 12 sections of court that have the same number of cases they had before the CAO of this current administration told us that there was going to have to be some major cuts. That does not impact the number of people in jail and the number of cases set for trial and the number of victims who are expecting and deserve for these cases to be dealt with. So there's no elasticity. There's no room for just random cuts, frankly, in the police department and in the DA's office and in the health department. Because even when we get past this budget crisis, if we cut too deeply into those areas, it's going to impact next year and the year after that.
So what are they telling you about 2026, or have you heard anything? At what point? Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll come back. 8:20, we're talking to DA Jason Williams. I understand what's going on in 2025. I'll ask you about the rest of 2025 when we come back in your office, and also what happens in 2026, because, again, it is an inelastic thing. You need what you need, and when do you find out what you get, what you get? Jason Williams, DA, our guest, 8:20, Traffic Now, WWL. 8:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to District Attorney Jason Williams. What are they telling you about furloughs or whatever with payroll and your department for the rest of the year? Are you guys going to get paid or not?
So Mayor Cantrell's proposed a very random 30% reduction to the DA's budget. That would be devastating. We are already a very lean office, and these cuts don't just trim fat. They will actually cut into the bone. That will mean fewer prosecutors, fewer support staff, but no fewer cases. There'll be less capacity to assist victims and witnesses through their worst moments. You know, and Tommy, just to put it simply, you can't pause a criminal case because there's no money. It's unconstitutional to defendants, and it is just simply cruel to victims who are waiting and deserve their day in court. But I believe the city council, the mayor-elect, understand that the mayor's proposed cuts just don't make sense, much to the same way that the differing numbers that they have been told over the course of the past year just doesn't make sense. And you know, I really hope that in this moment that the people of the city don't miss the Herculean effort that mayor-elect and this council are making behind the scenes, in front of the scenes, talking to anyone that will listen to show the measures and accountability measures that are being put in place so that we can stabilize this budget and not go backwards. We saw a great amount of success in the public safety space. Our No Dice program, working with the police department and the ATF and the state police, we saw an 83% drop in gun violence in Mid-City, a 72% drop in the Treme, a 48% drop in the 7th Ward. All of that success is going to backslide if we were to move forward with the mayor with Mayor Cantrell's proposal.
I think some of the unsung heroes in your department are the investigators. Are you talking about fewer investigators as well?
100%. I mean, when you start talking about when a case is made in January, by the time it goes to trial later in the year or that next year, investigators have dug deep and going to get Ring doorbell camera footage, talk to anyone else that might have been on the scene. Like, that's what gets a case beyond probable cause to proof beyond a reasonable doubt to get convictions against some of the worst offenders. And if we lose them, they're going to go to another parish. They don't have to work as hard, and we're not going to be able to get them back once we stabilize the budget.
So you got a 30% reduction. Crime remains constant. Prosecutors either don't get paid or get laid off. Investigators either don't get paid or get laid off. You got to give the defendants the trials. So does that mean guilty people go free? What does that look like, Jason?
Yeah, that's exactly what it would mean. It would mean that there would be cases that would either be delayed. Could cause a person or a judge to potentially reduce the bond, or they would file a speedy trial motion to try to force the case to go to trial because they know that there's been some furlough or cut in the prosecutor's offices. Or it means that my folks, who are already handling many, many more cases on their docket than any other prosecutors in the state, are going to have even more cases because we'll have fewer people working on them. It is not possible to work without with the 30% cut. It's just not possible.
So the budget that you submitted was more than 2025 for 2026 or the same?
Well, we tried our best to keep it the same as it was, realizing the situation that we're in, and we're putting into place every single austerity measure that we can find. But the idea of letting people go or furloughing people when the criminal legal system just does not stop and cannot stop really puts us up against the wall.
So I guess what I'm saying is, if you're talking about what a 30% reduction would do for the rest of this year, you can't really seriously look at a reduction for next year, else you'd be talking about just an extension for 2026, right? The same thing?
100%. But the good news is Joe Geruso is an amazing council member. He's paying very close attention. If you watch closely, Leslie Harris, Councilmember Harris, is shadowing his budget work because she's going to be taking over that work. So they're paying very close attention to everything and asking questions, looking for evidence of what's true and what's not true, because partners of the administration should have been giving accurate information to the council for the past year, and we could have been taking these austerity measures throughout the year so we wouldn't have this shock to the system.
So I'm just a little bit curious here, and I want to drill down on this. The 30% reduction you're talking about, that was proposed for 2026, and or what is the rest of 2025?
That was proposed for our next year's budget.
All right, so what's the rest of 2025 going to look like?
2025, I believe that based on my conversation with the mayor-elect and the current city council, that we're going to be where we need to be to take care of those cases that are on the docket and to make sure we don't lose essential personnel in the process.
So you're confident? You are worried? Tell me where you stand on this.
Well, I'm not sleeping very well, but I'm extremely confident in this council and the mayor-elect to find a way to get us out of this hole for the rest of the year. And they're looking at whatever it's going to take to get us there. And I also think they understand that there are areas that we can trim and there are areas that we cannot trim in order to get through this crisis.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. Jason Williams, District Attorney, New Orleans. We'll talk to Jeff Nowak about the Saints. We come back a little bit late. Time now, WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. All right, 8:45, quarter till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by WWL content producer and sideline reporter Jeff Nowak, one of the few men in the world who understands the NFL kickoff rule. How you doing, Jeff?
I think there's a few more this year that understand it, but I'm doing good. Tommy, how are you doing?
I'm okay, but I'm noticing some officials that perhaps are a little confused about it, maybe some players a little bit confused about it, some coaches a little bit confused about it, but you're saying somebody does understand it.
I believe so. I think that is the case, yes.
All right, let's talk about the Saints and the NFL draft, not NFL draft, NFL trade deadline. What's likely to happen, if anything?
Well, you know, I think those two things are connected. So it's, you know, because I think, you know, the Saints should be thinking about the draft today as they look at their roster and figure out, hey, who can be moved, who can't be moved. I think the bigger question is going to be what's the market on some of these players, right? Because I think there is some level of, okay, you can get a sixth-round pick for this player. Is that worth it? Just like, for example, Rashid Shaheed, right? He's in the contract year. Alonte Taylor, he's in the contract year. When you consider trading those players, you also have to consider, hey, if you sign them, you keep them. If you don't sign them and they go sign somewhere else, say Rashid Shaheed gets a $16 million a year contract from Team X. Well, it would actually make less sense to trade him now for something less than a fourth-round pick when you consider that you could potentially get a fourth-round pick or better as a compensatory selection for that player. So that does factor in. It does. This is not going to be a team that just goes into fire sale mode for the sake of making statement trades and doing that. But I do think you have to consider it just because, hey, I mean, there's a point where you just have to kind of make a statement to your roster and to your fan base that you are aggressively pursuing change. And, you know, when you're 1-8 and when you're losing games the way the Saints have the last 3 weeks, I think that's a statement that probably is worth making. So, you know, I it's tough to say exactly how active they'll be. I'd be surprised / disappointed if they don't make at least one reasonable sized move, you know, some mid-sized move. I don't think it's going to be anything groundbreaking. I don't think they have the players to move that would constitute a groundbreaking trade or kind of a blockbuster trade in the NFL. But right now they have 5 picks for next year's draft. They do look like they're still in line to get a 6th pick and a comp pick for Paulson Adebo, just an example of, hey, you don't trade a player, but you can still get something back for that player. So 6 picks, that's still not enough, right? When you're a team that has as many holes to fill as the Saints do. So, you know, a player like Rashid Shaheed is one that I would be looking at as saying, hey, you know, if there's offers out there, even if they might not meet your asking price, you got to consider him. Pete Werner, just in terms of he's a young player under contract that teams might have interest in, and you have a player behind him in Danny Stutzman that you want to get a look at, that would just make sense. You have some veterans who teams might be looking at, Dylan Raiden's, although, you know, obviously with Tally Fuaga going down with an injury, that your depth at offensive line is a little bit more of a question. Isaac Yiadom, who's a veteran player who might draw some interest. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. You have a few hours. There hasn't been a ton of rumblings yet, but it could heat up fast.
Do you know if artificial intelligence has gotten involved in any of this? Because I know it's good at running combinations and scenarios and so forth with what we can give up, what we can get, how it's going to hit us with the cap, et cetera. I know that's questions out of left field for you, but I was just curious about that.
Yeah, as far as I mean, you do have a lot of AI-driven data that's used. You know, I don't think that they're going to ChatGPT and saying, hey, should we trade this player?
Right.
But, you know, teams are using machine learning and stuff like that for their analytics all the time. I mean, that's the best usage of it so far. I don't think that teams are farming out their cap management or anything like that.
Well, I was just curious because you would think, man, that's so hard to keep track of. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 8:50, 10 till 9, more with Jeff Nowak when we come back. You got any questions, comments, you can text them in at 504-260-1870. Traffic now, WWL. 8:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, give me your thoughts on Tyler Shuck's performance on Sunday.
Yeah, well, he didn't run enough plays, which is frustrating. So you didn't see a lot of what the plan probably was, especially to start the game, you know, three straight three and outs. And part of that's on him, part of that's on the pass protection, part of that's on the play calling, whatever. But I did think that there was some positives you can pull out of that. Like, one of the only positives I can take away from that game is that two-minute drill that I thought he executed really well. You know, a lot of games come down to those situations. And, you know, he made a couple really nice plays on the move. His throw to Olave, where he kind of stepped up in the pocket and slid out and found Olave on the run. Was nice to see. Kellen Moore highlighted that on Monday. And I think one of the reasons it stood out was because that's a situation that I think over the first 8 games you'd see a scramble. You know, and scrambles in that situation, 3rd and 2 aren't the end of the world, but there are explosive plays on scramble drills that the Saints offense hasn't really unlocked. And I think that's somewhere that they can improve with Tyler on the field. I also thought he threw the ball pretty well in the second half. I mean, the fumble by Alvin was really frustrating because it came after a 10-minute drive by the Rams. The Saints finally get the ball. Kyler finds a nice completion to Juwan Johnson for a first down over the middle of the field, and then suddenly you give the ball right back to go on another 10-play drive. That's the third quarter. So it's really tough to assess how a quarterback played when you get 3 plays in the entire third quarter, 40 plays in the entire game. But he had another drive where he found Olave and Shahid with nice throws to the sideline, got down into the red zone. They got stopped on fourth down on a Taysom Hill run on that drive. So, you know, I think there are some positives you can pull out and say in a game that's closer, in a game that you generate some things on offense, you can take a step forward. It's easy to forget, hey, that's his first career start. I know he's 26 years old. He's still a rookie. So you're still in that kind of mode of, like, pull the positives out, build on those, try to erase the negatives, and or at least fix the negatives. There was one third down play that wasn't a fan of early in the game down by the goal line. It seemed like one thing you see on tape coming out of college is there seems to be a little bit of panic at times when there's pressure early, and he just kind of throws it away, and you saw that. It was a third down. A sack's not the end of the world there. You kind of just want to extend, and he just dumps the ball. You don't want to see that. But
well, what
I
is
think that – Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what does Kellen Moore tell a team? I don't know what he tells them, because he keeps saying, you know, it's the same thing. It's like deja vu all over again. We keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, and I don't know how you get their attention. I don't know what you do. Do you have any ideas?
It's a good question. I mean, you got to play better. There's just no way around it. Yeah. No one's going to come in and save you,
no.
Right? Like, you got to do it. I think that's the only thing you can tell.
Yeah, Calvary's not coming, or Calvary, right. However you say it. Boy, I tell you what, watching them Rams last year was the same thing. It's like watching Endymion. They start down here, and then they pass you all the way, right?
Keep coming.
And they keep coming, then it's over, and then you pack up and go home. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. We'll talk about some Becky Mowbray. We'll talk with her about BGR, about what's on the ballot in New Orleans, bond propositions, and so forth. And we'll wrap it up with Troy Carter. So a lot coming up. Stay with us. I don't want to get anybody mad here, but it's amazing how when you pass away, everybody kind of forgets stuff, and you know, the conflation between Iraq and Afghanistan seems to get kind of like lost in a shuffle, yeah, and which was a, you know, kind of big deal, kind of a big thing, and, you know, yeah. Hundreds of thousands of people dead as a result of that. And you'd think, you know, somebody would say, oh, by the way, he also, but nobody said it. Let's talk with Becky Mowbray now, shall we, about what's coming up on the ballot and leave her out of her mess. Becky Mowbray, president and CEO of BGR. Talk about what's on the ballot in New Orleans, bond propositions and so forth. Good morning, Becky. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm great. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Let's talk about charter amendments, then we'll recap some of the other things.
Okay. Very good. Very good. So on the November 15th ballot, there is a proposal to change the city charter in New Orleans to underscore the idea that the city attorney is supposed to represent all branches of government in the city, and they can't, favor the executive branch over the city council or some other entity in there. And this is on the ballot because of concerns that, you know, as everyone knows, the last few years have been marked by a lot of fighting between the city council and the mayor. And, and a lot of that came through with issues where it was felt that the city attorney was maybe not being as independent and neutral as she should have been.
How do you legislate that? I'm just curious because, you know, I know you said underscore, and that's not the word that's in the affirm, underscore, however you want to use it. But when you get right down to it, if for whatever reason, and I'm not implying that this is going to happen, but if the same thing should occur, mm-hmm. you would think that the charter pretty well says that now, right? So what difference is this going to make? And I'm not arguing against it, Becky. I'm just wondering when it comes to enforcement, how you enforce something like this.
Right. Well, that was one of our concerns. And so, as you noted, it already says in the city charter that the city attorney represents the entire city of New Orleans, capital C being the entity, the collective entity of the city of New Orleans. And that is reinforced by something called the rules of professional conduct, which are kind of the ethical rules for lawyers in the state of Louisiana. And, lawyers are required to follow these things. You can't, if you've got clients that sort of have a dispute, lawyers can't represent both sides. They need to step away from one or get different counsel for it. So, these things already exist. And our, so we felt like this proposed charter change was well-meaning. We totally understood where they were coming from, but we had a couple of concerns with it. One is that we just really felt like it was unnecessary because you look at the language of the proposed amendment and then you go to the charter and you look at what it already says there. It states quite plainly that the city attorney shall represent the entire city of New Orleans. And then again, that's backed by the ethical rules for lawyers. And, someone who violated that could find themselves the subject of a complaint or something like that. We also felt that it was perhaps unnecessary because you may recall, Tommy, a few years ago, the voters passed an amendment to the city charter that said that the city council now must confirm mayoral appointees to, the heads of departments that are listed in the city charter. And that includes the city attorney as one of those positions. So we've only used that process so far in confirming the police chief and a new DPW director, Department of Public Works. It hasn't been used yet in the city attorney's, for appointing a new city attorney. And it was our feeling that is a really important opportunity for the council to be able to make their expectations known. And, Council President J.P. Morrell has said his very first question at such a hearing would be, who do you work for? And, and so they will have ample opportunity to set the tone and really drill down and make it clear that anyone who's a candidate for being city attorney really understands that they have obligations to, both branches of government.
It wouldn't give anybody any additional redress or anything if for whatever reason the city attorney, the same thing should happen again, does it?
There is one other aspect of this proposed charter change, and it's kind of in the this is something that concerned us. It does add something new, and it says that if the mayor were to fire the city attorney, the council has the opportunity to overturn that termination. And the idea of that was to, just like on the front end, you would need to, get the council's confirmation of the person appointed to the city attorney. It would also involve the council, if things didn't work out and the termination of the city attorney. And the idea of that was that, say, the city attorney needs to make a lot of independent judgments where the there's a gray area of the law, and what the city attorney is recommending as the best course of action for the city may not always be popular with the mayor. And so I think the thought behind this portion of the proposed charter change was that, if the mayor fired the city attorney because the mayor didn't like the advice that they were getting, the council could be like, oh, no, 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 and overturn that termination. But our concern was that there could be a lot, you know, there could be good reasons why a mayor might want to terminate somebody. I mean, what if there are sexual harassment issues? What if somebody's not showing up to work, or, you know, just there are problems there? And if the council were to overturn the termination of the city attorney, think about it. The city attorney would be going back to their old job, where the mayor has expressed that they have no confidence in this person. And it hardly seems like you'd have a, you know, constructive working relationship. We just felt that it was better that could just introduce all sorts of problems. And they'd really probably be better off, you know, inviting the mayor to confer with them in an executive session and sort of, you know, explain. And that if things remained more in a consultative posture, it would be better. And there's also this term in that section of the proposed charter change about, you know, terminating the city attorney for valid cause. Well, what's valid cause? Like, that you could end up with more disputes about what that is. And certainly the council could pass an ordinance that would define that and help, you know, give the parties some guidance about what that means and when it's appropriate to fire the city attorney. But they haven't done that so far. So we thought that led to the potential for bad outcomes, and coupled with the fact that, you know, it already says everything that they want to say. It already says it in the charter. And the fact that there's this card to play with the confirmation process that hasn't been tested yet, it just seemed to us like this was all really unnecessary and perhaps not very constructive. And so BGR takes an against position on this proposed change.
Did BGR look at the other amendment to the Home Rule Charter?
We did not. We are a tiny staff with one research director and three researchers, and the ballot work that we did this, you know, on the bond proposal that we did for this, where there are actually three questions, and, you know, we also did a look back at the 2019 bond issue for background. We just simply had our hands full. So
the reason
looked at the city attorney one.
The reason I bring it up is it says, shall Section 5 404 of the Home Rule Charter of the City of New Orleans be amended to extend the deadlines for the City Planning Commission and City Council to act on the master plan and amendments thereto, as described in Ordinance Calendar Number 35, 155-30397, M.C.S. Now, for the average person going in to vote, they don't know what that means. I don't know. It could be simple house cleaning, right? It could be something that, well, this got lost in the details, so this needs to be done, and let's clean this up right here with this, because legally we have to. Or it could be something else at play, and I know that you all have limited resources, Becky, and I'm certainly not calling you out for not looking at this. I'm just wondering, what advice would you give people on deciding whether to vote for this or not?
Well, I mean, I would, you know, maybe reach out to your council official or someone on the City Planning Commission, or, you know, Tommy at WWL had time. I think inviting either someone from the council or the City Planning Commission on to explain what it's all about, I think would be very helpful.
We'll do that, Becky. We'll invite somebody on and find out what the hell's going on, because, again, it could be something benign, right? It could be something where, look, this for whatever reason was left out of the original, and we need to clean it up to make this more efficient, or maybe something else is going on. Who knows?
Yeah, or maybe they need a little bit more flexibility in doing reviews or something like that to, you know, make things function better with the master plan. But I would love to listen to such an interview because we did not have the chance to check it out ourselves.
Well, we'll do it. Well, Jordan Fee will get that done for you, I guarantee you. 9:22, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about bond issues, all right?
Thank you.
Recap that, you bet. We're talking to Becky Mowbray, President and CEO of BGR. You know, we're of the opinion here, if you're going to vote, you may as well know what the hell it is you're voting on and what your vote means, so it can't hurt, right? We'll continue to talk about it when we come back. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 927, talking to Becky, Tommy Tucker, talking to Becky Mowbray, President and CEO of BGR, Bureau of Governmental Research. We've already talked about the city charter amendment that they've looked at. And Becky, to be clear, the city charter is like the city constitution, correct?
Yes,
to be changed,
right.
The voters have to approve any changes. So we've already talked about that. Last time you were on, you talked about the three bond propositions that are on the November 15th ballot. People have already begun voting. I just wanted to recap those with you, and we'll take them one through three, perhaps, would be the best way to do it.
Sure, absolutely. So, there are three bond proposals on the ballot for voters in Orleans Parish on November 15th. They would, if approved by voters, they would authorize the city to sell collectively $510 million in bonds that would pay for upgrades in city infrastructure and equipment, drainage and stormwater management, and affordable housing.
Let me jump in real quick just to be clear, because people hear things and they get confused. This has nothing to do with payday loan. This has nothing to do with bonds. This has nothing to do with anything that's been discussed before.
That is correct, okay. Tommy. The headlines coming out of the city about its finances are terrible. This is a separate thing. Okay. This is about creating resources that will allow the new mayor and incoming council to keep the project going, that will improve, things in the physical, in the built environment and in facilities around our region at a time when citizens, are very frustrated with the lack of repairs.
So what did you guys find on these bond proposals?
Okay. So we looked at each one individually using our standard framework that asks the same questions about planning, financial management, accountability, and effective outcomes for citizens. We were against the affordable housing proposition.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5.
I know where I'm going to bet from now on.
Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, a board-certified OBGYN and menopause specialist. My new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it really takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Every week, I sit down with medical experts, cultural icons, and powerhouse women to talk about what really matters: your health, your power, and your future. We're covering hormones, identity, finances, relationships, and so much more. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Unpaused with me, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
And for the infrastructure position and for the drainage proposition. And that's the order that they appear on the ballot. So the affordable housing proposition would allocate $45 million to affordable housing. We recognize that housing is a vital issue in the city. It's something that holds us back. But, and we would love to support something related to housing. But we did not feel like this one was up to snuff. They propose using the money to pay for the housing charter or the housing trust fund that voters put into the city charter last year. That requires that the city each year put in the equivalent of 2% of the city budget and spend it on housing related issues. We think there's, you know, a good framework for plans and things like that. But what we didn't like is that when voters made that change last year and the city council proposed it and voters approved it, it became a required recurring expense. And what was said at the time is that the city would pay for that. Well, now they're proposing financing that and using, you know, one-time money from the bonds to pay for this thing that is a recurring expenditure. That is a bad practice. It's also a short-term solution. If this bond issue is for $45 million and its next year's contribution would be required to be about $14.5 million, that means you get a maximum of 3 years.
Would this be tantamount, Becky, if I might jump in, would this be tantamount mm-hmm. to taking out a mortgage for rental property?
You're borrowing money
that you have to pay back over a long period of time for one-time expenses, right?
Well, it's a recurring expense. I mean, every year the city's going to have to pay this.
With no equity, no capital investment is what I'm saying.
It's not sustainable that a general principle in budgeting is that you should pay for recurring expenses with recurring revenues and that you should, you know, only take on recurring expenses that you can afford on a regular basis, that you've got enough money coming in. And, you know, so here the city is saying, well, no, we're going to use the bond money. And, well, that means it's a really expensive way to pay for a long-term recurring expense that, if they make a $14.5 million contribution as the required contribution for next year, well, by the time you pay that back, over the life of the bonds, that's going to end up costing the taxpayers $24.1 million. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's one thing if you're doing streets or infrastructure or things like that. But this is something they're going to need to be paying for every year. And then it's also an incomplete solution. Like that $14.5 million that's required to be paid is, it includes like some overhead costs and things like that that you can't use bond money for. So it just felt like a square peg in a round hole and was not the right way to go. So while we support the city doing something about housing, we don't think bonds are the right way to pay for this.
Let's move on to infrastructure. Let's go to infrastructure and water retention.
Yes. So those are the next two on the ballot. Infrastructure is $415 million, and the drainage and stormwater management is another $50 million. We were in favor of both of these. These are core needs for our city that, as everybody knows, the roads are in horrible shape and people regularly have homes, businesses, and cars that flood when it rains. And this is a way to start making a difference in that, to give city leaders some resources to keep moving forward on things. We felt like there was really good accountability on this. They've got a published list of projects that would be that they would fund, and if they want to change that, if they want to make any changes to the list, it has to go back before the city council so the public would have a chance to weigh in. And so we felt like there was really good accountability. We are encouraging the city, if voters approve these, to create public-facing dashboards that would also swing in the status of the projects and the amount of money that they cost, so that residents can really see where their money is going and understand the progress. Our one caveat on these is that I want to take the opportunity to say the city has historically done a terrible job of maintaining infrastructure and maintaining buildings. And they have got to start changing the way they handle that, because if voters are approving these bonds, we're going to be paying them back for 30 years. And you should be able to expect as a citizen that you're getting long-term improvements in our built environment. And if the city doesn't maintain streets and doesn't clean out, you know, clogged catch basins and things like that, repair broken pipes, things like that, then we as citizens are not getting the full value of the investment. That, you know, if you don't seal cracks on a road, the potholes are going to come in and maybe you only get 12 or 15 years out of it instead of 30. So we're calling upon the city to make some improvements.
And very quickly about the stormwater retention?
Same thing. We were in favor of it for all the same reasons as the infrastructure one.
Thank you, Becky. Appreciate your time as always. Becky Mulberry, President and CEO of BGR. We'll talk to Troy Carter, U.S. Congressman, when we come back. 9:36, 24 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 9:42, 18 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by U.S. Congressman Troy Carter, Democrat from the state of Louisiana. How you doing, Congressman?
Hey, Tommy, how are you today, my friend?
I'm all right. Look, let me just ask you, I'm be straight up with you. President Trump on 60 Minutes said it was up to you guys to open the government. Why don't you open it?
I wish it were that easy.
I know.
I wish it were that easy.
I know. Tell me.
You know, and I'll tell you, if it were that simple, it would be open. And I will tell you this.
Tell me what the sticking points are, please.
Listen, we were there prior to the shutdown. This is not a surprise. We knew a shutdown was looming if we didn't act. We offered ourselves to be at the table to negotiate and talk about things that needed to be accomplished. Like, for example, we knew that the ending of the ACA tax credits were looming. We wanted to have a discussion about that. We knew that the National Flood Insurance Program would expire. I had a bill to address that. It was never called to the floor to vote prior to the shutdown. There's a lot of moving parts involved. It's not as shut and dry as some would suggest. Listen, Congress is and has always been a deliberative body, a body that requires discussion, conversation, negotiation, compromise. We don't always have to agree, but we cannot simply say we're not going to talk. And, you know, that's where we are now. This notion, open the government, then we'll talk. Why can't we talk at the same time? Listen, we have now entered the 35th day of a government shutdown, equal to the last time President Trump was in office and there was a shutdown. It was also 35 days. It cost the taxpayers $11 billion. No one wins on this scenario, Republican, Democrat, or other. Now we find ourselves in a situation where we are facing yet another insult to injury in that people are not getting their SNAP benefits, and that should have never been subject to what happens with a government shutdown, to be frank with you. Last time there was a government shutdown, there was no disruption to SNAP benefits, none whatsoever. And it's 60 years inception. Since 60 years of the SNAP benefit program, there has never been a disruption. Think of all the natural disasters and all of the issues that has plagued our country, including shutdowns. There's never been a disruption of SNAP benefits. I say that to say that it appears to be more of a strategy, less than a necessity, to exact pain from the American people.
Let me tell you something,
and
Representative.
I always say that is just unnecessary.
Let me jump in for a second. I'm just a guy. I'm a dumb guy from the West Bank, all right? I'm not a Troy Carter or a Noel Norman or a Clancy Dubose, any of these people. But to me, it just seems like now we have gone into inflicting pain, where we're going to try to inflict as much pain as we can so that people get hurt. The logic of half SNAP benefits makes no sense to me. Either you're going to fund it or you're not. But to say, the logic of, okay, you need SNAP benefits, but I'm only going to give you half of what you need. either you need them or you don't, as far as the logic goes. So I don't understand where you come with half SNAP benefits. Do you get that, or am I missing something?
Tommy, you're far too modest on your intellect, my friend. You are spot on. You are 100% accurate. There is no reason that there should be any disruption, let alone dangling only half of the benefits to the American people. This is nothing more than brinkmanship. This is nothing more than exacting pain. I couldn't have said it any better than you. And it's unfortunate because, you know, this is take off our partisan hats. Call it Republican, call it Democrat, call it whatever you want. We're Americans first. And you know as well as I, and you don't have to be a political scientist to realize that the federal government is vast in its resources. And I already illustrated that the last time there was a government shutdown, there was no disruption of SNAP. Mm-hmm. But this time there's a disruption of SNAP because there's a strategy at play. And unfortunately, the American people are being used to facilitate a position which is just not the way to do government.
What do you think that strategy is, Congressman? What do you think the end game is here?
I think the strategy is to squeeze the negotiation or the lack thereof into having the president's way, and that is do what I say or else. The president has made it very clear he's not going to talk to Democrats until he gets his way. And we're saying, no, that's not how negotiation works. That may be how you build your Taj Mahals and all the other things, but that's not how government works. Government is not a business. Government should have principles of running fluidly and efficiently, like some businesses are. But government is not for profit. It's for service. It's to take care of and to provide resources to build a robust economy so businesses can thrive and to adjust itself to modify for the needs of our domestic and foreign affairs. This notion that we're going to just bring things to a screeching halt and starve people. Might I add, the people that are hurting, they're not just Democrats, although he seems to think in his comments, not my words, his, that most people on SNAP are Democrats. That's not accurate. But even if it were, it would be cruel and unusual. I know you know that people throughout Louisiana, throughout the entire country, red or green, red or blue, blue or black, yellow or orange, white or whatever, Republican or Democrat, use SNAP benefits.
I know 40% of them are kids. I know 40% of them are kids, and I don't know if it's a math problem or not, but it would seem like it wouldn't be a far extrapolation to say that 40% of the kids, 40% of them, of the people that get food SNAP are kids, and that they're going to get half of what they need to eat. Is that too far or not?
No, I think that's very fair calculation.
So let me, before we run out of time.
Deeper than that, when you talk about people that are disabled, you talk about the elderly, when you talk about people already making a determination, can I afford my full prescription? Do I pay my utility bill? Do I pay my rent? Do I eat?
Congressman, let me come at it from the other side. Let's say this. Let's say the president and the Republicans say, tell you what, we'll fully restore SNAP tomorrow. You guys pass this continuing resolution, and then we'll start talking about the Affordable Care Act tax credits, which I found out yesterday overwhelmingly go to people in red states, not blue states. And I don't think that that's something that the Republicans are going to win on. Given the political nature of that, would that be something that would interest you, or are you going to the wall? Go ahead.
No, we've got to go to the wall, and I'll tell you why. Because this cat and mouse game of holding the American people hostage while you get what you want and withhold what the American people need, you've just said it. And listen, I enjoy your show. I listen to you regularly, and your commentary is very smart and very pointed and fair. And that's what I love about you. You call balls and strikes, Republican or Democrat. I love that about your show. But here's the reality. The facts are, if you don't extend the tax credits, if you hold them out as some type of bargaining tool, the American people will hurt. It begs the question, just like you asked a second ago, why not extend it? Why not extend it now, other than trying to make a point and to make the people hurt? our position is very clear. This should have been done before. So now we don't know that we can trust you to do what you said you're going to do. And once we give in, the American people may suffer further.
How do you see this ending? We're almost out of time, Representative. How do you see this ending?
Because I'm optimistic, I see it ending with us extending the ACA tax credits. I see us finally extending SNAP. Unfortunately, there are going to be a lot of hungry, hurting people that will be in the mix before that happens. The end game will be the game that we're asking for now. Ultimately, the things that we're asking for will happen. Unfortunately, the cat and mouse game of making the American people hurt further will come first.
I got to ask this. Do you see how the Republicans win on this affordable tax credit thing, because Affordable Care Act tax credit thing? Because, again, there are a lot of Republicans that are benefiting from this.
Tommy, there's no way to win this, because I did a town hall last week and I had Republicans and Democrats participate. And one by one, as people called in, they are disgusted that the ACA tax credits are even in this discussion. They should not be. They have nothing to do with the government shutdown. We don't have to. When the government is shut down, Congress can still be in session. Yet we haven't been in session for more than 6 weeks. We could be voting every day on these issues, notwithstanding the government shutdown. The CR is not the only thing we vote on. We can vote to extend the National Flood Insurance Program, which, by the way, is now expired. Mm-hmm. We can vote to extend the ACA tax credits, which will be expiring. Do you realize that without the National Flood Insurance Program, you can't buy a new home? You know what that does to our economy? You can't refinance your home if you need flood insurance. You know what that does to our economy? You can't develop a major project that requires flood insurance. That's going to cripple our economy. We should do better.
Thank you, Representative.
I had a bill to fix that.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. 9:53. We like to hear from all sides. 7 till 10. We'll take a break. Come back, WWL.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.